Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for June 21st, 2007. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. We've got two segments, as usual, tonight. First, we'll hear from Tara McKelvey, who is the author of a new book called Monstering, which is a look beyond the famous pictures as to into what happened at Abu Ghraib prison, where U.S. soldiers and private contractors tortured Iraqis, and we will find out more about that. Which is now a mostly forgotten story, at least in the United States, but something that should not be forgotten. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Lee Badgett, who is a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts and also a visiting professor at the Williams Institute at UCLA Law School, about this is our observation of upcoming Pride weekend. Lee Badgett, who is an economist who specializes in labor market issues concerning gay and lesbians, gays and lesbians in the, and transgender people in the United States, and we will hear from her on the economic aspects of workplace discrimination and same-sex marriage and gay and lesbian adoption. Before we get to all that, just a few words about what's been going on in the financial markets for the last several years. The dominant force, or close to it, in the financial markets have been so-called private equity funds, PE for short. Yes, hedge funds, those giant pools of speculative capital that move in and out of markets with lightning speed and have been known to bring entire countries to their knees, hedge funds are much better known. But they've been around a long time and have gotten much more than share of popular attention. Private equity is only beginning to get that kind of attention, so I thought I'd say a few words about the phenomenon. There are some similarities between PE and hedge funds. Both are made up of capital contributed by institutional investors like pension funds, university endowments, and rich individuals, and are run by a relatively small group of very highly paid money managers. But their investment styles are very different. I've mentioned the lightning speed of hedge funds. They're also omnivorous. They can move into distressed Peruvian bonds or the Tehran stock market and out again as the fancy strikes them. Private equity is another story. Their modus operandi is to buy up whole companies, public companies, that is, one whose shares trade in the open markets, take them private, slim them down, and sell them, again, either to other companies or to float their stock in the markets again several years hence, having allegedly worked their magic on them. The numbers surrounding PE are huge. There are over 170 funds with more than $1 billion in assets. As a group, they raised $221 billion last year from outside investors, up sevenfold from a decade ago. They did almost $500 billion in deals last year, almost 13 times as much as they did just 5 years ago. Most of these deals involve taking public companies private, and remember, public in this context means owned by outside shareholders, not by a small group of individuals, and certainly not by the government. Private equity is a bonanza for the fund managers. They pay themselves huge fees, typically 2% of the assets under management and 20% of any profits that ensue. But that's not all. As former money manager Andy Kessler points out in today's Wall Street Journal, there are transaction fees for doing the deal in the first place. Hertz was bought for $4.4 billion plus debt incurred and transaction fees and expenses of $439 million, and monitoring fees to keep tabs on their investment. Toys R Us pays $15 million a year to its outside its private equity investors. There are also consulting fees, investment banking fees, and even termination fees when the company is flipped back to the public investors again. Where does all this money go? Some of it goes to outside investors, but studies have shown that the returns earned by those pension funds and university endowments who provide the cash are really not all that out of line with what's available in the broad stock market. The lion's share of the profits go to the PE managers themselves. And where does all the money come from? Mostly from the companies they play with. Costs are cut, which means wages are cut, jobs are eliminated, and surviving workers are forced to work harder for their paycheck. The racket is getting so big and bloated that it's looking like some kind of top is at hand. Confirming that impression is the fact that Blackstone, not the biggest but certainly the most famous of all the private equity groups, is itself going public. Its shares are to be priced tonight, and it will begin trading as a stock tomorrow. The offering has proved massively popular, with demand exceeding the supply of shares by about 7 times. You have to wonder why. The prospectus, the legal document that announced the terms of the offering, was very clear. The Inner Circle of Blackstone would retain all the voting rights, shareholders would have no recourse. The Inner Circle would pay itself what it deemed appropriate, and the public shareholders would have to be content with the leftovers. If there's ever a conflict of interest between the Blackstone management and the public shareholders, the managers were likely to resolve it in their own interest, and the shareholders would have no recourse, etc. Why would anybody buy these shares? To participate in some magic that it's not quite clear that Blackstone's current owners are about to share. Or rather, it's quite clear that Blackstone's current owners are not about to share that magic. The two top dogs of the firm, Stephen Schwarzman and Peter Peterson, are going to take out over $2 billion from the deal. Why should anyone buy something from these guys, who are the last word in insidery smart money? More broadly, the whole thing feels like the end of the 1980s. Then we saw a similar wave of buyouts, with investors borrowing lots of money to take per firms private with the hope of cashing in several years down the road. It worked for a while, and then it got malignantly bloated. All the debt incurred left the firms extremely vulnerable to an economic downturn. And when the economy did weaken after 1989, those vulnerabilities were exposed, and the U.S. economy stagnated for the next 3 years. It feels a lot like 1989 again. Let's take a musical break, and then we'll hear from Terry McKelvey. A bit from the Au Pairs, their 1981 song Armagh, named after the prison in Northern Ireland where the British tortured lots of rebellious people in that part of the world. And, of course, we do torture, and we're not a civilized nation. And we'll hear some details on that from Tara McKelvey, who is the author of a new book called Monstering, just out from Carolyn Graff Publishers. She's also an editor at the American Prospect magazine and a contributing editor at Marie Claire, and a fellow at NYU's Law School, the Center on Law and Security. And here's an interview with Tara McKelvey, recorded yesterday at the NYU Law School. I have to start by asking, how did you get interested in a gruesome subject like torture?
Yeah, it's a good question. I certainly didn't set out to do the story. It happened by accident. I was interviewing a woman who was in Iraq working to open up women's shelters, and she told me a story about an American soldier who had apparently sexually assaulted or raped an Iraqi woman. And this woman had been apparently on the lam, hiding from her family. She was in danger of an honor killing. And the story about this woman was very disturbing because, of course, it was a time when we were very optimistic about what would happen in Iraq. And the idea that American troops were creating problems for an Iraqi family or possibly endangering the life of a woman was upsetting. But I didn't know how to report on the story or how to pursue it. And then a couple weeks after that, I had dinner on Capitol Hill, and a senior aide to Senator Boxer told me about female detainees at Abu Ghraib. And I was very surprised to hear that there were women who were held at the prison. And I thought, well, I know what happened to the men because I'd seen the pictures. And I just thought, what do they do to the woman? So because there was Senate questions about the woman who were being held there or who had been held there, it was a way for me to investigate the story about what was happening with Iraqi women.
Now, of course, everybody's familiar with the pictures from Abu Ghraib and Grainer and Lindy England, but there was quite a cast of characters assembled there. So give us the rundown of the dramatis personae.
Well, there was a whole group of people that were not in the photographs, that were apparently involved in some of the abusive acts. And some of these individuals took pictures. I mean, I got access to a whole bunch of pictures and videotapes about stuff that was going on in the prison. And there was kind of this world that they had there where they would do these weird drugs called robo-tripping, which is a combination of Robitussin. You sort of chug down a bottle of Robitussin, and then you take a couple of Vivarin, and then the effect of that is kind of like being on acid. So they set up these party rooms. They turned one cell into a party room, where they would have these sort of rave parties with electronica music or sometimes outcast songs. And they would trip. They would just, like, drug out. And then they would sometimes pretend to stab detainees, like to have... They would turn, like, a chair into a human dummy, and they would act out violent acts on the detainees. And these were the people who were in charge of escorting the detainees from their prison cells to the interrogation sites. They were part of the official...
Were they just blowing off steam, or are they rehearsing?
It depends upon how you interpret the films. What I saw was very graphic, very violent, and the person who gave me the videotapes was at the prison at the time and was friends of these guys, and he would sort of quote from the films and say things like, you know, something like, yeah, that's what they're going to do, or that's, you know, that's what we're planning on doing, and stuff like that. I mean, it was very suggestive.
So there are those guys, but then there are also private contractors who were, played a pretty important role. Who exactly were they? What did they do?
Well, the private contractors, some of them were interrogators, and the dynamic at the prison was interesting because you had all these army guys who were there because they wanted to serve their country, and then you had these contractors who were there partly because they wanted to make money. I mean, their salaries were, you know, they made between $50,000 and $120,000, and they also didn't, you know, they dressed like civilians, so they had, like, you know, cool haircuts, where they wore fleece jackets, and so they were like the hot guys at the prison. And, you know, Sam Provence, this man I interviewed, said that, you know, all the women were after them, and they were like the popular ones. And they were also in charge of some of the interrogations. So they would, you know, according to Provence, would behave very aggressively and very violently towards the detainees. And
do they have any expertise, or are they just on the make?
Some, I mean, it's difficult for me to say. I know that, for instance, the interpreters who were sent all over to Iraq were often unprepared for their jobs, and some of them had told me they got very little or no training in what they were supposed to be doing.
And the translators themselves, some of them had their own agendas, didn't they?
Some of the translators who were hired had certain prejudices against different ethnic groups in Iraq, and that created a lot of tension in the field. And a lot of the stuff that took place was sort of beyond the knowledge of the American troops because they couldn't understand the language.
And then there were the OGAs, which I presume is not pronounced ogres.
No, I didn't think about that. That's actually a good way to put it. And I think they behaved in a pretty ogre-like fashion, at least according to the people who told me about some of the stories. Yeah, the OGAs, the T-shirt guys, whatever you want to call them, you know, they were from the CIA or other government agencies, was the official description. And they were there doing interrogations also.
Did anybody have a strategy for these interrogations, or was it just improvised as they went along?
Well, there certainly were strategies that were supposed to be put in place, and one thing that was interesting to look at is how they had guidelines set up for interrogations, and apparently some of these guidelines were put in place at Abu Ghraib. There was a process that was known as the Gitmoization of Abu Ghraib, and during this time they were trying to transform the prison into the central intelligence gathering place. And some of the guidelines included things like things that could be used on the detainees, like dietary manipulation or sleep plans, or stress positions could be imposed on them.
Stress positions sounds innocent, but what are they really?
Stress positions can mean all sorts of different things. Officially, it means putting a person in maybe an uncomfortable position, like in a crouch, or in one of the photographs I saw, there was a detainee who was crouched on two plastic white chairs facing backwards. The official rules say that they're not supposed to be in that position longer than 45 minutes, but then after a break, they can be put into another one. The problem with stress positions is that they also mean things like what's known as a Palestinian hanging, where a person's arms are tied behind their back and they're held in, or suspended by their arms, which, as you can imagine, is incredibly painful and can lead to dislocation of the shoulders. And in fact, there was one man there named Jamadi who died while being held in that position. He became known as the Iceman because of the photograph that was released.
How typical of the photographs we saw, how typical were those of what was going on behind those walls?
The story that I wanted to tell was what happened beyond the frames of those photographs, and the abuses that I heard about from former prisoners was much more brutal than what was shown in the pictures.
Such as?
Things that when I was told what happened, I almost couldn't believe it or didn't want to believe it. And I certainly put in place a very careful vetting process. I didn't believe all the stories that I heard. The people that were talking to me, they had an agenda many times. Many of them had been important people in the former, you know, regime. And so I was very skeptical about their stories. The ones that I was able to check out and verify were the ones that I, you know, pursued the most aggressively. And they were stories about electrical wires. One man, a lawyer who had actually visited the United Nations in New York in 2001, talked to me one night when I was in Amman, Jordan. We were in a hotel room, and he described the types of interrogations that took place. And then sort of at the end of our conversation, he was sitting on like this luggage rack in the hotel room, and he lifted up his pants leg and showed me this red hole where electrodes had been placed during the interrogation.
Now, we have Lindy England and Charles Grainer are both doing time. Anybody else suffer any consequences for these horrendous actions?
The military has investigated more than 600 accusations of detainee abuse, and more than 260 individuals in the military have faced some sort of punishment, administrative or otherwise, for detainee-related abuse dating back to October 2001. At least 9 individuals have been sentenced to time behind bars.
Grainer and England themselves are, you know, we've certainly heard a lot about them, but how typical are their, you know, their resumes? Lindy England worked in a chicken plant and, you know, was going nowhere in West Virginia, and then the Army was her ticket out. Is that the reason that a lot of the soldiers were there?
I think they're pretty typical of soldiers in the Army. They saw it, certainly Lindy England saw it as a way to pay for college. But she wasn't. She's a smart woman, and you know she did well in school, and she was
really. No, she's been presented as you know, with an IQ of 80. I mean, that's the popular image of her.
It's not true. I spent a lot of time with her in the brig in California, and she's very bright and curious about the world. And when I was there, she was studying electrical engineering. She told me she could fix my iPod.
Those are expensive, so that's a valuable skill. But Grainer had a horrendous history, didn't he? He's a prison guard with some questions in his past, but that didn't matter.
There was a federal suit against Grainer during the time that he was a prison guard. A prisoner accused him of placing a razor blade in a side dish of mashed potatoes, and the prisoner bit down on the mashed potatoes and cut the inside of his mouth and was bleeding very, very badly. Grainer is also admitted to assaulting his ex-wife. I mean, there was a clear record of physical violence.
I'm speaking with Tara McKelvey, who is the author of Monstering, Inside America's Policy of Secret Interrogations and Torture in the Terror War, just out from Carroll and Graff Publishers. Now, let's address the question of responsibility. Or at least a very standard explanation of this is these are rogue elements out of control. Do you buy that explanation?
Well, they were rogue elements, and they were out of control. There's no question about it. But the reason that they were doing stuff was partly because there were guidelines about what kinds of interrogations should be taking place at the prison. These guidelines were posted. They were signed by Rumsfeld. And the stuff that you saw in the pictures was not in the guidelines. But there was a climate of lawlessness at the prison that wasn't being checked.
When I interviewed Cynthia Enloe about this a couple of years ago, she said that, you know, it's almost a part of the military structure that someone at the top gives an order, kind of vague, make this happen. And then by the time it gets down to the Grainers of the world, it gets much more brutal, but the guys at the top can deny their responsibility for it. Do you think there's anything to that kind of explanation?
That's one description of what might have happened. I think it's important to remember, though, that there were individuals at the prison. I interviewed one soldier named Hydrie Joyner in Washington, D.C., and he was at Tier 1A, where most of those photographs were taken. He was told to implement what was known as a sleep plan, keep the prisoners awake for long periods of time. So he played music in the cell, and he said he just basically went through a million batteries, you know, in these boom boxes. And actually, when he was first told to put together the sleep plan, he said that it sounded like a really weird thing, and he said, I want to see this in writing. It came down to him in writing, so he started the sleep plan. He did it for a period of time, and he told me that he was in his office in the cell block. At a certain point, he said he felt his blood starting to boil. The music was making him crazy. He went over and he turned it off. He stopped the sleep plan. You know, he disobeyed orders, but nobody said a thing. So my point is that each of these individuals had a choice every step of the way whether or not they wanted to proceed with these orders or not.
Like Nuremberg, just following orders is not a defense, right?
They had a choice.
There are people who say that these are terrible, terrible stories, but we have to do it. It's really necessary in this war on terror, whatever precisely that means, to get the kind of information to protect Americans. Do you buy that argument?
Some of the people who say that, they'll say things like, whatever we need to do to get the information, let's do it. I don't want to know about the details. But I would say you need to know about the details. If you're going to condone this kind of behavior or support it, what happens in that room with an interrogator and a prisoner is really important. It's you got to know exactly what goes on there, and then you can make a decision about whether you think that's a good idea.
Is the information, you know, some people say that the information that torture elicits is not very worthwhile because people say anything to get the torture to stop. What about that?
There's a lot of evidence that shows that the information that is gotten through these sessions is not useful. But in fact, some of these sessions do produce actionable intelligence, as it's known. Certainly, they were able to locate Saddam Hussein through a process of interrogating a whole bunch of different people in different parts of Iraq. And then through sort of, you know, like John Pike of GlobalSecurity.com says, through a process of sort of hauling people out and interrogating them and maybe not using, you know, the most polite language during this, they got tips about where he was, and they were able to track him down. So I don't think it's enough to say that it's not useful intelligence. And also, what if someday they were able to graph out a chart that shows, in fact, torture does yield actionable intelligence a certain amount of the time? Would then we say it's okay to use? I think we need to ask ourselves, is this the kind of country that we want to be that uses these techniques?
There's always the ticking time bomb of defense of torture. Are there any actual examples of such a thing?
Well, that's one of the problems with the argument. It's certainly trotted out all the time when people talk about torture, and there are so few real-life examples. One case that's cited often is a case in Germany where a police chief threatened to torture a suspect in order to have him reveal the location of a boy who he had kidnapped. In fact, the boy was found, but the boy was dead. So even in one of the few real-life cases that exists, the information that would have been obtained through torture would have been useless.
Abu Ghraib was busted and shown to the world. Do we know? Are there other things like that going on out of view?
Well, the people that I interviewed who had been held in U.S. detention facilities told about all sorts of abusive techniques that were used, all sorts of horrific acts during these interrogations, and also simply being in U.S. detention. The fact that the photographs were shown give us a pretty horrific and vivid image of what happened during those weeks, but the story is much bigger than that.
What about the legal framework under which this grew up? Has that changed at all?
Well, the president is now examining whether or not, or what types of techniques can be used by CIA officers. It seems to me, I mean, it's been published that it looks like waterboarding may not be an option for CIA officers, but the fact that these conversations are being held in secret and that very few Americans are privy to them makes it very difficult to say what's going to happen.
It was amazing during the Republican debate, 9 out of the 10 candidates were all for torture, essentially, and only John McCain, the only one with any kind of military experience, was against it. Now, first of all, what is it about the only guy with military experience who himself was tortured would be the one against it? But what about the political prospects for the future? Is this just now kind of established as a way of doing business?
Well, there was also Ron Paul, who...
Oh, yes. I have many apologies for getting my hero, Ron Paul.
I want to give him credit for taking an anti-torture stance. Yeah, it's pretty surprising. I mean, a few years ago, nobody would have said that we would be having a debate about torture in America, and now it's incorporated into pop culture with 24 and other TV shows. Like you said, it's in the Republican debate. The majority of the candidates said that they would do it. It's something that you need to say in order to show that you're tough. The problem is people are not really aware of the reality of it. And if we're going to be using torture techniques or coercive, you know, things that are actually known as torture in international law, well, then codify it. You know, do what Alan Dershowitz says. Send out torture warrants or issue torture warrants. There's kind of this schizophrenia right now where were saying that these things can be allowed and can be done, and certain candidates are proposing, you know, or supporting it. But it's just, you know, the whole attitude about it is completely messed up.
Well, is that just people don't want to codify it? They want it to operate in this sort of murky legal realm where it happens, but they don't want to know about it?
Yeah, again, it goes back to, I don't want to know the details. Well, then who is going to be enacting these things? You're going to have these interrogators out there making decisions about whether or not to torture someone. And then if they make a decision that's wrong, well, then we'll prosecute them. That's like hanging somebody out to dry. I mean, if you really believe as a nation that we should be using torture, well, then let's put it on the books.
And were the revelations at Abu Ghraib, were you surprised the fact that it seems to be largely forgotten? It was revealed, it was a scandal for a while, and now it's American amnesia has taken over. Is it possible to keep this, you know, in full view?
Forgotten by whom? Not by people in the Middle East. The U.S. prestige in the world had already sunk to the low in 4 or 5 decades, in March of 2004, before the Abu Ghraib photographs were released, according to a Pew poll. There was a Coalition Provisional Authority poll that showed before the release of the photographs, 63% of Iraqis supported the U.S. invasion. 3 weeks after the release of the photographs, only 9% did. Americans may have forgotten about the scandal, but people in other parts of the world have not.
And that was the voice of Tara McKelvey, who is the author of the book Monstering, which is a look at the full story behind the Abu Ghraib prison torture crime and outrage. That book just published by Carolyn Graff. Tara McKelvey is also an editor with the American Prospect magazine and a fellow at the NYU Center on Law and Security. I mentioned an interview I did a couple of years ago with Cynthia Enloe, and here's an excerpt, 3 minutes or so, from that first broadcast, actually in May 2004. Cynthia Enloe, professor at Clark University and an author of many books, famous perhaps most notably for her work on women in the military, or sex in the military, sex and gender in the military. But let's listen to what Cynthia Enloe said 3 years ago.
What do you make of the bad apples defense? You know, is this a couple of low-level people gone wild on their own, or do you think this was scripted by professionals who really knew what they were doing?
What we need to do is ask that question, and then ask it again, and then ask it again. We know from every assassination attempt, from every corruption behavior that's been revealed anywhere, that the favorite response to try to dampen our collective and individual curiosities is to say that is an exception. What we've all learned from Tailhook and from the Air Force Academy rape revelations and from Watergate and from My Lie, what we've learned, but we have to keep relearning, is always ask about the entire organizational decision-making process and the entire institutional culture. What is considered normal? What's considered trivial? What's considered allowable? What's considered outrageous? And those things build up over time. And so it's very hard when you have people further up an organization, which in the military people talk about it as chain of command, but you could take any organization. I think feminists have become very smart about this because they have had to learn all these skills to make sense of how sexual harassment happens in a law firm or in an automobile manufacturer or in a military. And that is, you at the top and in the middle, the directives that accumulatively make up the culture look either benign or bland or quote-unquote civilized, rational, modern, if you will, suited, whereas the further down the hierarchy, the actions taken to carry out those oblique or direct instructions from above look cruder, look more obvious, look more blatant. So it doesn't mean that the people, the men and women, that is both Charles Grainer and Lindy in England and their compatriots in the military police unit, the reservist unit, doesn't mean they shouldn't be held accountable. They absolutely should be held accountable. But that's the beginning of the story, not the end of the story. And the further up the chain of command we get, and that should go right outside the uniform into people around Rumsfeld, Rumsfeld himself, and I would say right into the White House. It will be harder to be outraged because it will sound blander. Those instructions will sound less outrageous. And we've really got to learn how to be outraged at things that, at least at first hearing, sound bland.
And that was the voice of Cynthia Enloe, who's a professor at Clark University and also author of many books, and she's most famous for her analysis of sex and gender and masculinity and femininity in the military. And let's take a break for station ID, and we'll be back.
Yo, this is Michael Franti from Spearhead, and you're listening to non-commercial radio in New York. WBAI is the place to turn to.
Oh my God, and my mother got us living suicide singing. Oh my God, and my mother got us living genocide singing. Oh my God, and my mother got us living suicide singing. Oh my God, oh my God.
And this is WBAI in New York, also on the web at WBAI.org. And my name is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back, if the telephonic gods agree, with Lee Badgett. And that was a bit for the Butchies, their debut album from 1998, The Galaxy is Gay. And we're having a little trouble raising Lee Badgett, so let's... And we're back. And we do have Lee Badgett on the line after a couple of telephonic challenges, but all's well that ends well. And this ruined my segue out of the Butchies song, Oh, The Galaxy is Gay. But let's see if I can repair it. The Galaxy is not gay, at least not yet. And so we need to speak with Lee Badgett, who is an economist who specializes in the economics of labor market and other experiences of gay, lesbian, and bisexual Americans. Welcome to WBAI, Lee Badgett.
Thanks, Doug. Great to be here.
Lee is a professor at the University of Massachusetts who is visiting at the UCLA School of Law, the Williams Institute. And what is the Williams Institute exactly?
We're a think tank on sexual orientation, law, and public policy. So we try to put together the facts that will inform all these big debates about gay and lesbian issues.
Sometimes that seems like a frustrating job trying to have facts inform American political debates, but we have to keep hope alive, don't we? So let's start. We have several topics on the agenda here, and since the New York State same-sex marriage bill was strangled by the state Senate leader Joe Bruno last night or the night before, and it's just outrageous that these two guys, Shelley Silver and Joe Bruno, essentially control the New York State legislature. Joe Bruno doesn't want to bring this to a vote, so it's not going to happen this year. But anyway, you were involved in a were advised a study by the controller of New York City on the economic benefits of marriage equality for New York. And this comes as a bit of a surprise that actually there would be economic benefits to allowing same-sex marriage in New York State. How is that?
Well, it's true. Most people think gay couples are trying to get certain kinds of rights that come with all these economic goodies, and of course those must cost somebody money. But in fact, what what my colleagues and I have found in a series of studies outside of New York is that pretty consistently we see that same-sex marriage or giving same-sex couples the right to marry would actually save states money. And so when the New York City Comptroller's Office took this on, basically they found exactly the same thing. We were we provided them some census data, and they did all the number crunching on this one, but found pretty much the same kinds of findings that we found. And some of it, a lot of the advantage economically comes from the fact that weddings are just incredibly expensive. People decide this is, they hope, their one day in the sun, and the one time they're going to go through a wedding, and so they go all out. In fact, the average wedding in New York is said to be about $32,000, which is pretty
cheap.
Amazing.
When I spent more of my second wedding than my first, and it was nowhere near that much in any case.
Yes, you can certainly do it for a lot less, but that's the average. So a lot of people can do it for a lot less, and some people obviously do it for a lot more. But when you take into account the fact that there are thousands, tens of thousands of gay couples, gay and lesbian couples who would love to marry, and you know, there's the old stereotype about gay people loving a party. No matter how you think about it, it's still likely to be a real boost. And they made pretty conservative estimates of how much gay couples would spend, not even spending that $32,000, and still they found that in New York City, if you take into account both the couples who live there and the gay couples from other places who are going to come to take advantage of the opportunity to marry, that's about $142 million in the first few years.
And that would be people who come to New York just because they could get married here and they couldn't get married in their home states, not because New York is such a great place to come to.
Well, it's not known as a wedding mecca. That's true. It is a wonderful place to visit for lots of other reasons.
It's
but
not
now,
Vegas, though.
Yeah, that's right. It's not Vegas. But, you know, it could certainly start to look like that for gay couples if New York were to take some action, because Massachusetts still doesn't let out-of-state couples marry except for the handful or so who live in Rhode Island. So that would be money for the city. And then, of course, there are other couples in the other parts of the state, and that would be another $184 million. So you add it all up, and it's a pretty good chunk of change. It would be going to the wedding industry. That means new jobs. That actually also means a lot of tax revenue for the state and for the city. So, you know, that would add another $5 million or so to the state budget and to the city budget. So these aren't enormous numbers, but they're very large, and they're positive, and it's,
yeah, they're significantly greater than zero.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, what about the health benefits and such? What would the fiscal impact be?
That's the thing that a lot of employers say they're worried about. If they have to treat same-sex or gay and lesbian employees, new spouses, in the same way they treat heterosexual spouses, then it's true there will be more people who will be getting health insurance, and I think we can certainly argue pretty easily that that's a really good thing, but from the perspective of businesses, they're worried that they'll have to pay for it. But when you sit down and figure it out and look at the real number of couples who are likely to get married in the whole state of New York, the Census Bureau counts about 50,000 couples, and about half of those are in New York City. You start, you know, taking out the ones who already get domestic partner benefits, the people who unfortunately don't get health insurance through their employer at all, and make different kinds of adjustments like that, you actually don't get very many new people who are going to be covered. And then you spread them out across the hundreds of thousands of businesses in New York City and New York State, and the chances of any single employer actually having to cover somebody new is pretty small. And the ones that are going to be covering a few new spouses aren't going to be covering very many. So, you know, the total impact you know, might be something on the order of roughly $30 million a year across the state for all of those, for all businesses combined. That's not, you know, each individual business would just get a little chunk of that.
Now, you just said a number of same-sex couples in New York, and I've seen you and others do this fairly often,
yeah,
which is based on numbers that come from the Census Bureau, people who tell either the decennial census, the census every 10 years, or yearly supplements, tell them that there's same-sex couples living together.
Right.
How reliable are these numbers, do you think?
Well, you know, I think they're not perfect, but they're better than a lot of people think. Right after the 2000 census, I did a study in Washington, D.C. at the big march that happened in 2000. And we surveyed hundreds of couples, and we did some online surveying. And there certainly are people who are concerned about confidentiality. After all, the census form does have your name and address on it, and you're telling the federal government that you're gay. And some people don't want to do that. Some people's households are too complicated to see them in those forms. So we know we do miss some people, and it's hard to know exactly how many. I can tell you, in 1990, there were about 150,000 couples across the whole country that the census counted. It was four times that in 2000. So it looks like, you know, people, probably not that there are a lot more gay couples, but it's probably more because people are more willing to say they have a same-sex partner. And then,
of course, there's no reason these numbers would be overstated. They're understated, if anything.
Yeah, most likely. That's exactly. Yeah, we think they're likely to be understated. And actually, then by 2005, it's gone up another 30% about 770,000 across the whole country. So there's definitely a trend towards people being willing to be more open about their relationships.
Yeah, now as it approaches a million, that gets to be a serious number of people involved.
Well, that's true. That always does sound a lot bigger. Well, actually, if you multiply
by two, yes.
Times two, there you go. You got your million there.
Yeah, a million and a half, more than a million and a half. So that's a lot of people involved.
Yeah.
And if it's significantly understated, we're talking about a sizable demographic group there.
That's right.
Which leads me into the next issue, which is adoption and foster care by gay and lesbian parents. The standard cliche in a lot of the straight media is that, or even some of the gay media that's trying to sell advertising, is that gay people are carefree, affluent. They're not. Don't have to worry about spending money on kids. They can spend money on discretionary consumer goods. But that's really not a fair picture, as your work has demonstrated.
No. Gay and lesbian people are, and their families have lots of kids.
Yeah, these numbers are surprising. How many have kids and how many would like to have them? So run those by us.
Yeah, and I think that's going to only increase, just like the number of couples reporting. So I think, right now the census and another data set that we've looked at suggested about a third of lesbians have either had kids or actually still have children living in their household. And even 15 to 20% of gay men do, and that's big. And then if you ask them...
Now, are these kids from previous relationships, or are they, do we know?
It's a mix. It's a mix. Probably a lot of them are from previous relationships. It's really hard to tell in the data. We're always looking for new ways to figure that out, and we just haven't come up with a really great one to identify that yet.
Yeah, I know quite a few of them, but I don't think I have the most random sample.
No, probably not. Most of us don't, because our social networks are so much like ourselves. But these broader data sets tell kind of the same story. So about a third of lesbians and 15 to 20% of gay men already have kids. And then if you ask them, would you like to have another child or a child if you don't already have one, and about half of both groups say, yes, I would. And that's pretty striking. That suggests to me that we'll be seeing a lot as the laws loosen up and it gets easier for gay couples to have kids. I think we'll see a lot more in the future. And we also asked them about their interest in it. Well, actually, we looked at data. The federal government actually asked them on a survey related to health and family growth. They asked them whether or not they've ever considered adopting children. They asked this of lesbians. And about roughly, if you think about it from the perspective of the whole population, about a million lesbians would have considered adopting at one time or another, and that's probably about the same number of gay men who've considered adopting. Actually, maybe even more gay men than that. So you figure there's a good pool out there of about 2 million lesbians and gay men who are interested in having kids, who've thought about adoption. And we think that those folks are ripe for social welfare agencies all across the country for enlisting those folks to be foster parents. You know, some of those will be on the way to adoption, and some may just be temporary foster care parents. But that's a big pool that's pretty much untapped in most places.
I'll speak with Lee Badgett, who is a professor of economics at University of Massachusetts Amherst and a visiting fellow at the Williams Institute at the UCLA Law School. So what is the legal status of gay adoption and foster parenting around the country now?
It's mixed. There is only one state that has an outright ban on adoption, and that's Florida. They won't let gay, lesbian, or bisexual people adopt at all, although actually they will allow those folks to be foster parents. There have been some other states that have had bans that were recently overturned by courts or were in the process of being sued, and then they decided to change their policies. And one state, Arkansas, has a pretty concerted effort underway right now to try to go back and add to either the state law or to the Constitution a ban on adoption by gay men and lesbians. And from time to time, in the aftermath of a lot of the marriage debates in states, there have been some legislators who pop up every now and then all over the place in Indiana and Tennessee and Georgia, places like that, and say, well, you know, the next step is to ban gay parents, gay people from adopting. So far those folks have not yet been successful. But we do know also that a lot of adoption agencies and social workers show signs of discriminating against gay men and lesbians just because of their sexual orientation. So it can be still a difficult process for gay people who want to adopt or foster.
You find that such a ban would actually be costly. How much,
yes.
and why?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I could talk about the actual dollar values, but I mean, that sounds a little bit crass when you're talking about children's lives to start with. But we did make some calculations about what would happen. We estimate there's probably about 14,000 kids across the country who are in foster care with lesbian and gay parents. And if you said, we're not going to let those gay parents foster anymore, you've got to put those kids someplace else. So at least some of those children are going to have to probably go into some sort of institutional setting, which is more expensive for the state to pay for.
And far worse for the kids, of course.
And it's far worse for the kids. And they'll have to recruit new families to take over for the ones who are no longer allowed to foster, and that's going to cost money. So if this happened nationwide, which is not very likely, but we'd be looking at something like $87 to $130 million a year. But the cost to kids is really what's most troubling, I think. There's all sorts of research that shows that instability and foster care placements and just yanking kids around and putting them in different places, so that leads to lots of bad outcomes. They have behavioral problems, mental health issues, academic delays. If they're in foster care all through their childhood, they have many additional financial and life challenges once they turn 18 and aren't in the foster care system anymore. So it's really much better for kids to have stable homes with parents who are well qualified, which, you know, gay and lesbian people go through the same screening process that other foster parents do, they are, you know, they have actually, if you look at adoptive and foster care parents who are gay or lesbian, they actually have very high levels of education, and those are all characteristics that tend to, you know, suggest that they're going to be good parents and be good places for kids to grow up.
Well, it's interesting. A lot of people who profess to have family values at heart are willing to let kids bounce around because of their troglodytic ideas of what a family is.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that this would be anything but tragic for the kids who are involved.
All right, and then let's move on to a third topic. You've got a study coming out early next week, but we're getting a little advanced look at it.
Yeah.
Behind
the
News, Bias in the Workplace, Consistent Evidence of Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity Discrimination. There is a cost in the workplace to being gay, which may not be a surprise to most people, but you've actually done some rigorous work to put some numbers on that. So how bad is it?
Yeah, it's surprising that we still see so much clear evidence of discrimination. I mean, people think the world has changed a lot for gay and lesbian people, and it certainly has, but there's obviously still a ways to go. We have taken a look at over 50 different studies and have found that pretty much all of them show that discrimination exists in the workplace against gay men and lesbians and bisexual people, actually, and transgender people. We also looked at them in the study. If you want to just, you know, take a look at the hit to the pocketbook, a whole series of studies by lots of different economists and sociologists show that gay men actually earn less than similar straight men, ranging from a 10% wage gap up to almost a third less than heterosexual men, depending on the study.
Now, that's a magnitude similar with what you see in studies of race and sex discrimination, isn't it?
Yeah, it's actually a little bit higher.
Yeah, because I think 10 is what sticks in my mind for a lot of that stuff. But this is 10 is the lower bound on these.
Yeah, so it's very noticeable. It's quite noticeable, and as you mentioned earlier, it really cuts against that stereotype of gay men being this really affluent elite group. The income numbers tell a real different story. Lesbians, it's more complicated.
And that's not just because of job choice. This is you're controlling for all those sorts of things like occupation and experience and education, all that stuff.
Yeah,
just to make
that
clear.
So that's just looking at the gap between people who have all the same kinds of characteristics. Yeah.
And what about lesbians?
Yeah, that's more complicated, actually. Lesbians in some studies look like they earn more when you compare them to heterosexual women, and that could very well be because lesbians are not taking time out of the workforce. They are less likely to have kids, although many of them do have kids, as we talked about. So those kinds of factors might help them if you compare them to heterosexual women, but, you know, heterosexual women are not exactly in a great place themselves, and so lesbians still earn a lot less than both gay men and heterosexual men. So,
now, is there an issue here of not conforming to gender stereotypes? Is there a penalty to be paid for a man who doesn't act manly and maybe some gain for a woman who acts kind of manly?
People have suggested that. It's hard. We don't have the right data to really look at it that directly. But actually, one of my colleagues here at UCLA at the Williams Institute, Danielle McCartney, who's a sociologist, has done some really interesting work that shows that the main reason why lesbians earn more is because they go into male-dominated jobs, or they're more likely to be in male-dominated jobs than are straight women, and male-dominated jobs are still the ones that pay the most. So there is that.
And then female-dominated jobs, of course, there's a big hit to be taken.
Yes. Yeah, and that hurts. The gay men are a little more likely to go into those jobs. It doesn't make that's not the big factor that drives their wage gap, though. But it is the thing that gives lesbians an advantage, or at least makes it look like they have the advantage.
And then finally, we only have about a minute or so, but you also looked at transgender discrimination. What's up with that?
Yeah, we did find a lot of studies that have asked transgender people if they've experienced discrimination in the workplace. And depending on the study, anywhere from 6 to 60% said yes, they have. We don't have the same kind of comparisons in terms of earnings, but in these studies, an appalling number of transgender people report very, very low earnings, like somewhere between 22 and 64% earn less than $25,000 a year. So these are people, this includes people who are well-educated, and you would expect them to make a lot more. So there's likely to be a very large transgender gap as well.
All right, well, thanks for joining us, Lee Badgett. Lee Badgett is a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and a visiting fellow at the Williams Center at the UCLA Law School. Well, there's certainly plenty to celebrate going into Pride Weekend. There's still some work to do. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news, and until the evening, and I'll be back next week. And let's go out with this from the newest album by Adult, the Detroit techno duo. I can't remember what the title is. Sorry. The album is called Why Bother, but I don't have the song title in front of me, but here we go.